All right, we are standing by for Representative Antonio Delgado's latest town hall meeting. Today he's in Otsego County, and we will attempt to tune that in. It should be a couple of minutes. Usually they start about 5 minutes after the hour. So I'm going to see what we can do to get the signal, and we'll be back as soon as we do with Representative Antonio Delgado's latest town hall meeting live from Otsego County on the radio at WGXC Acre 90.7 FM. This is Scanner, Lithia Water. Thank you. We're now going live to Otsego County, where Representative Antonio Delgado is giving a town hall meeting right now, live on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Number of things to happen. For me to get to a point where I thought I had no choice but to honor my oath, even if it meant that it might lead to more partisanship, unfortunately, and more divisiveness. I did not run for office to impeach the president. It's not why I signed up. I signed up because I wanted to serve the community. I wanted to serve those folks who have felt left behind by both parties for a good while. And as somebody who grew up in upstate working class family, who benefited mightily from a different era where everyday Americans were put first, that's what drove me. And so I was trying to keep my head down, trying to work, trying to get things done. I didn't go there to be a show horse. I went there to be a workhorse. And we were doing that, and I'm going to keep doing that. I'm going to keep doing it. But something happened when the president admitted his words. And that to me was the difference. He admitted that he solicited the aid of the foreign government to investigate a political rival. That, in my estimation, is a violation of his responsibility as oath and under election campaign law, it's a crime. And when you get to that level, when you're talking about national security, when you've lived through what we all know has been, no doubt, a meddling of our elections, every intelligence agency has concluded that we had to endure that in 2016. No American should want any foreign meddling in our elections. This is our democracy. We decide the outcome of our democracy, full stop. And any American that sees that it's okay to welcome, to prop individuals or foreign actors to have any role in the outcome of an election is not putting the country first. They're not acting as if they care about the welfare of our democracy. They're not protecting our Constitution, as the president is obligated to do in his oath of office. Now, I'm not here to, nor I don't think anybody should, at any point, and this is for all my Democrats, take joy, celebrate in this reality. It is a sobering moment. We don't do this a lot in our country when you are put in this position. This is a time for us to really come together to the extent that we can and truly try to figure out a way to put country first. We have to go through with the process of getting to all the truth, getting to all the facts, and hopefully along the way we can overcome some of the divisiveness that all too often I find happening, not just on the ground, but more importantly, and I think frankly, in the way the media covers this, the way journalists cover this. We've got to transcend all this and figure out a way to come together as Americans and understand it's about our national security. It's our national security. It's about protecting our elections. And for me, at the end of the day, I can't put anything above our democracy and what we mean to ourselves and to the world. So, we're going to keep doing the work. There's work happening right now in Washington. I'm home. Okay, make that clear. I'm here. I was here all week. I was doing work around rural broadband. We had a big public field hearing yesterday with the commissioner, Jeffrey Starks, talking about the need to bring rural broadband to the community. We got some stuff going on next week around opioids. I'm going to have a roundtable discussion with folks who are dealing and putting on the front lines, working on the front lines to address that issue. So we're going to keep doing this work. Okay, but before I open up for questions, I do, if I may, want to spend a couple minutes telling you what I've been doing. I think it's important for you to hear that the legislation, the other piece of the job here, that oftentimes you don't read about, you don't see, but we try our best to communicate to you, and that's also why I want to do these town halls. You know what we're doing. I've got three bills that we've introduced that actually have passed the House. Okay, there's three bills that I want to focus on first. One of those bills didn't just pass the House, it passed the Senate, which is Republican control. And it was signed by the President. So we have a bill that we introduced out of my office that is now law, and it's a bill that helps our small family farms. We don't have big ag, corporate ag in our district. We got family farms in their view. About 5,000 or so across the district, about 8,000 farm operations. One of the backbones, they're a critical piece of our identity in terms of who we are as a rural community. And yet, when you have the trade tariffs that we're going through right now, market consolidation that's happening, USMCA kind of up in the wind, no one knows what's going to happen there. Our farmers are falling off a cliff. And we get the Secretary of Ag, Sonny Perdue, saying the demise of family farms, said this 2 days ago, is inevitable. His words, the demise of the family farm is inevitable. This is their head, the Secretary of the Department of Agriculture, saying this. Now, come on. Obviously, we have a statement of response. Because it's not about inevitability. It's about choice. It's about priorities. It's about we in the government and what we're doing with our subsidies, our tax credits, and who we're choosing to prop up at whose expense. So that was a big piece for me in terms of how we provide more relief to our family farms. There's a current cap, or there was a cap, on who is eligible to seek Chapter 12 bankruptcy relief to reorganize, have some debt forgiven, and remain operational during this down farm economy. That cap was $3 million. So if you had a property value that was over $3 million, you weren't eligible to seek that kind of relief. Well, we bumped it up to $10 million. So now more and more farmers can have access to seeking out this relief. Bipartisan bill, passed the House, passed the Senate, and signed by the president. Not a cure, not a panacea, but it's relief. And it's helping our family farmers. In the same vein, a bill I introduced that allows our students who want to seek farming, who want to take on the practice that their parents may have or their grandparents may have, let's treat farming like a public service. If we do, we could have them have loan forgiveness. That loan forgiveness will allow us to do away with their debt that's saddled them, take on farmland, and carry on the traditions of those who came before them. That is how we can help our farmers here at home. That's one area. The other bill that I introduced that passed the House, and hopefully we'll get to the Senate, came out of the Small Business Committee. Now, Democrats, Republicans, we can have our debates about how many regulations are enough. The one thing we should be able to agree on is it should be as easy as possible to comply. I don't think we should have much debate on it. Well, the bill that I introduced out of the Small Business Committee creates a one-stop-shop website that is housing every single bit of compliance regulations for all small business owners to go to and figure out exactly how they can comply. Currently, there are about 25 different websites you gotta track down to figure out exactly which rule applies to what thing you gotta do. And that adds cost to doing business. We don't want to price people out of being small business owners. In the same vein, a bill I introduced. How many folks know this, but small farmers or sole proprietor business owners, they cannot currently deduct their premiums for healthcare as a business expense. Can't do it. So you know, right? You can't do it. That's ridiculous. A bill we introduced that allows that to happen. And hopefully we'll do that through the House and the Senate. Again, how we can help our small business owners and our farmers get through some difficult times. The other piece that I introduced, a bill that passed the House, is called the CLEAR Act. This is part of the big HR 1 package that was meant to help give government back to the people. It includes a lot of things. For example, instead of having politicians draw congressional districts, we let independent commissions draw congressional districts. All the time. How do I bring folks together? How do I find common ground? How do I do the work that transcends partisan politics? And that's what I think leads to the Family Farm Relief Act. It leads to a bill that helps our small business owners. And it leads to this CLEAR Act that I talked about, which would allow us to not only get things done like independent commissions, but when we have folks who file their FEC reports, we want to know who gives them money. Are they lobbyists? If they're lobbyists, who are they lobbying for? The CLEAR Act does that. You look up an FEC report, you want to find out who's giving you money, you might just see the name, you might just see the address. My bill would also say, if you're a lobbyist, you should say you're a lobbyist and for who, on that same report. Have it all in one place. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. People have to be able to see where you get your money from. It changes the behavior.
Lost the signal temporarily. Let's see.
When it comes to math, a few more things. Healthcare. Only developed country in the world without some form of universal healthcare. I am one of the few members of Congress that has introduced a bill that will get us universal healthcare through a public option bill called Medicare X Choice Act. This gives everybody the choice, if they want, to opt into Medicare. If you like your private insurance, don't want to change, you can keep it. But if you're looking for a more affordable option that sets a floor in the private insurance marketplace and does build the monopoly that the private insurance companies have right now on the system, a public option does that. In the same vein, the skyrocketing pharmaceutical companies and drug prices. Right now, Medicare has no authority to negotiate with drug companies, which is insane. That'd be like you walking into a car dealership and saying, you know what, I'm just going to forego my powers to negotiate. Just give me whatever's on the price of the car. But in this case, it's the government who represents us telling the companies, don't worry about the people. Just give us the price and we'll take it as is. The only reason why that happened is because the pharmaceutical industry lobbied with money elected officials to put that power aside, put our power, the people's power, aside. I haven't met a constituent yet. Anybody in my community yet who says, yeah, that should be the way it goes. Nobody. The irrespective of party. And that just tells you how corrupt the system can be if we don't stay engaged. climate change, extreme weather events, the impact it has on our farmland, the health of our soil, the seasons. We got to do more to get out in front of these extreme weather events. We've got to do more than just do lip service. We got to think about what the future might be for sustainable job growth here at home. That means we have to stop propping up the fossil fuel industry. They're making a lot of money without our help. They don't need the tax credits and the subsidies. They're fine. They're making a lot of money. Take those tax credits, take those subsidies, and put them into renewable energy. Put them into wind, solar, geothermal. Considering things like a carbon fee dividend, where we go to the very front end of the supply chain and tax the supply side at the very front end, and then have a dividend to everyday Americans who can offset whatever price gets passed down with the pricing of the gasoline. Using that money, we can then begin to actually build out job centers that lead to growth. I have a bill that I introduced called the Green Jobs Opportunity Act. Okay, this bill requires the Department of Labor and Energy to do a one-year study on what jobs we have to hit and fill to get to net zero carbon emissions by 2050. We can't get there by 2050, might not be any turning back. This bill, once we have the study done, will take that information and then fund pilot programs at the community college level, high school level, and even the middle school level to educate young people for exactly the kind of jobs we need to have the ability to hit that goal by 2050. A targeted approach that creates a green economy, that creates jobs that are sustainable, that pays good wages. That to me is how we can get our minds wrapped around this issue of the climate change. On top of that, carbon sequestration technology that allows our farmers to figure out how they can be a part of the solution by using techniques that trap the carbon. We can do that again with tax incentives and credits, but we're throwing our money away at corporations and industries that are outdated, outmoded, and we don't need anymore. Without the proper ability to transition, we've got to be able to let go. Slowly, methodically, but with a purpose that leads to the desired end, which is to keep our environment safe, our water clean, and our air free from pollution. And with that, I'm going for a while to stop. But I want you to hear some of the work that I've been doing, because I think it's so important to understand that, yes, there's a lot going on. The stakes are very high right now in D.C. and all across the country. But there are folks, and I try to make sure I'm one of them, who are just trying to do the work, who are trying to serve the people. But we might not agree on every issue. And if we do, then great, but it's very rare that's going to happen. But at the end of the day, we can agree to disagree at times, do so civilly. And we got to get back to that in this country. So with that, I'm going to open it up for questions. My only request is that if you raise your hand, I just did the long model. So if you raise your hand, if you want to ask a question, ask the question. I'd love to take the question just to save everybody time. It'd be good to get the question and have a nice Q&A. But from that point on, we're good to go. So, yes?
You mentioned green jobs. Right now, the plan for our state on the budget is put a gigawatt of offshore wind power. And one of those things require 50 pieces of equipment, like wind turbines. If you see a couple of dollars, it would be a good place to put a lot of those questions.
Yes, no. Listen, the thing about what makes this place so special is the natural advantages that we have. The valleys, the mountains, the water, you know, we have so much of it. We're blessed in that regard. So our ability to harness our natural resources, our ability to harness renewable energy relative to other parts of the country is pretty strong. We have the capacity to do a lot of work here with proper investment. And in the same vein, it goes to our ability to grow food. We should be the breadbasket of this part of the country. This part of the state and beyond, downstate. We have the capacity. Right? So with the proper investment in renewable energy, with the proper investment in the health of our soil, with the proper investment of merging what's happening in our climate, what's happening on the ground, you can begin to see a vision for a state in a way that we haven't been able to see it for some time. And I'm trying to piece together every bit that I can to craft that vision. Part of the problem right four decades. Seriously, ever since globalization, we had the trade agreement that took workers off.
Seems like their camera fell or something. They're trying to fix it, and hopefully the sound won't crease shortly.
Best educated workforce in the world. We were the top five. something to stop the expense of college education at the expense of vocational education. So what can we do about that?
That is an excellent point. Excellent.
One of the things that I think about, again, going back to my childhood, my parents preached how education was the gateway to opportunity, the great equalizer. All I heard in my house growing up, it almost drove me nuts that they said it so much. But they had a point. The point was, this is going to be a chance. No matter where you start, no matter your race, no matter your class, hit the books, you know, work hard, you never know, you got a chance. That whole reality, that the investment in education, and not just the four-year college. Because see, the thing is this, what ended up happening was we kind of got fat as a country. We kind of were running the world for some time. We were really the only superpower for quite a while. And so we felt like we could just sort of send everybody who wanted to go to college, go to college, we'll get you a job, we'll find a job. We stopped really focusing on public schools and investing in this notion that everybody has a fair shot if you give money back to where they start. And we stopped investing in vocational schools and trade schools and apprenticeship programs because there was money in the higher education world. And think of it like this. When I was in college, they didn't charge interest. They didn't actually charge the interest while you were in college. They had an interest rate. It wasn't charged while you were in college, because you were in college, you were learning. The interest rate mirrored the treasury rate. It was tied to the treasury rate. 2-3%, 7-9%. So something shifted over those 40 some odd years where people thought of higher education as a way to make a dollar. And we started treating it as a profiteering exercise as opposed to a public good. Mm-hmm. As a public good. And now you see with folks like Betsy DeVos at the helm, right, who refuses to even go to a public school, hasn't even stepped foot in a public school to assess, is it working? What's happening with our young people? Are our teachers getting the support that they need? We're not doing any of that work. And it drives me nuts that in 2016, we had three debates. Not a single question back in 2016 about education. Not one. Now, you are not talking about education. You're not talking about the future. You're not talking about the future. You know what else was asked about in 2016? Free debates? Climate change was asked about. Free debates. So what does that say about how we as a country are thinking about the present? It's the status quo. It's maintaining what is. And who's maintaining what is? The folks who like what is. Right? The folks who like where we are, who don't want to move forward, who don't want to leave behind outdated, outmoded means of generating energy, who like the fact they're making money off of the school system. That's why loan forgiveness programs, a robust loan forgiveness program. I'm all for a national service program. We say, listen, if you want to join the armed services, if you want to go to a Peace Corps, if you want to teach for America, if you want to come work in a nursing home in the rural community, if you want to come work on a farm in a rural community or a hospital, we'll forgive you your loans for 2 years. Work for 2 years, your loans forgive for 2 years, you're good to go. You free up young people, they become risk takers again, they take chances, and that's how you grow the economy. So I just introduced my last point on this, education is a big deal. I just introduced a bill that puts a lot more money into Pell Grants. You know, Pell Grants, which are meant to help low-income individuals with access to higher education, Pell Grants used to cover 70% of a four-year college education. They now cover 30%. 30% of a college education. It's disgraceful. It's disgraceful. We spend more money propping up with subsidies and credits, big oil, significantly more than we do on the Department of Education. We spend more money on corporate welfare than we do on the public welfare, promoting our young people and our future. So I hear you loud and clear, and I'm going to do everything I can to keep fighting for public school investment. I'm a big believer in universal pre-K. I think leadership should be behind CTE education, career technological education is important. Matching unions more with the work that's happening in schools to prepare our folks. And the fact that we have counties in our district where the average age of a plumber, for example, is 60 years old, or a mechanic is 60. appreciate you bringing that up. Yes.
Thank you.
This was the first bill of Democrats led. Big package. It didn't just include independent commissions. It also included making Election Day a holiday.
Yeah.
Now, why is that important? Well, when people are struggling, working, trying to find childcare, you know, it's taxed to be expected to wait in long lines. When you try to vote, it starts working. If we're moving in democracy, we believe in democracy, make it as easy as possible for folks to vote. Automatic registration, early voting, same day registration. These are all things that are in HR1. And the reason why that's so important is because we're not going to be able to overturn Citizens United, at least in the near future. Just so you know, this is a case that allows unlimited amounts of money to pour into our system. And we have no control over that. That needs to be changed. But the one way we can do it now is to give as much power to the people as you possibly can and make it as easy for folks to vote. Because no amount of money can erase your right to vote. And that number counts. Now, it can be suppressed. There is voter suppression. But guess what? HR1 has that too. HR1 talks about what we can do to curtail voter suppression. Right now, there are practices across the country where if you didn't vote in the last go-round, they purge you from the rules. So you show up, you're ready to vote, but well, you're not here. And you're not here because they took you off the rolls so you didn't vote the last time, instead of keeping you on. Or they might send you non-forwardable mail. And if you don't respond to their mail, you're off the rolls. This happens in states across the country that are competitive states. States that can go either way, right? So New York might not happen in one of the blue states. But these are the kind of practices that are happening that are really affecting voter turnout. So it's voter suppression. It's making sure we enroll people. It's independent commissions. It's the clean rap that I talked about. It's also making sure that folks of limited means have a chance to run for office. One of the things that I hate the most about this job is how we're raising money. It's horrible. I mean, seriously, it's horrible. But it's a necessity. You literally have no way around it. Because if you don't raise money, and I'll take corporate PAC money to be clear, all money from people, from individuals, which makes it tough because you gotta really go, you gotta really work for it. Can't rely on some big corporate check coming to save the day. But I'd rather have it this way, because I'm only accountable to the people. But the fact is, if you don't raise money, you're gonna bring a knife to a gunfight. Because they're gonna come in with millions and millions of dollars and just blanket their airwaves with all types of nonsense and misinformation, and no one's gonna stop. This is all legal. It's all legal. So making sure that we allow folks of limited means, public financing, to run for office, have matching dollars, so anybody who wants to run can have a chance to run and not be priced out of public service. This is what's happening. People are being priced out of public service. Change that dynamic. Now, I've talked to the leadership and talked to a few folks about, well, why don't we try breaking it up? Take pieces. This is a lot. That's a lot in HR. It's one big package. So if you go to the Republicans and say, you know, we want all this passed in the Senate, they might be like, that's a little, it's quite a bit, right? So I do think it might be helpful to kind of, you know, do a piecemeal. I'm not saying that's actually going to work per se, because unfortunately we are pretty partisan in divisive times, and we reached this probably about 300 bills at this point out of the House. Good stuff that is being blocked. Consistently in the Senate. 90% of folks want universal background checks. 90% of those people. So you have 90% of folks who want something. You have a bipartisan bill passed in the House. But one man can say, not gonna happen. This, in my estimation, no better example of how broken the system is. When 90% of people want something in the country, you know how hard it is to get 90% of Americans to agree on something? Yeah. We have 90% of us who want to agree on this, and we can't even get a vote in the Senate because gun manufacturers have a stranglehold on politicians. That's it. It's that simple. So, yes, you know, there's a lot of things you can do with HR1. It's critically important. And I'll just say one more point on this, because it's tied to the amount of inequality we have in our system. When you have all this money in our system, and it's dominating the national agenda, the issues that we care about don't get brought to the floor because we don't have the means to access them. We access the elected officials. So, for example, when you have 2/3 of Americans living paycheck to paycheck, 2/3 of Americans, or when you have 0.1% of the country owning a fifth of all the wealth, when you have income inequality as high as it's been since we started recording in 1967, okay, we have all this inequality, and yet money dominates assets. You don't have a democracy anymore. You have an oligarchy. Because only the folks who have the means and the capital and the wealth have the ability to access their elected officials. And the more and more of us who are trying to struggle and get by, make ends meet, are being shut out of the system. And that is why you can't get a situation where, you know, 90% of folks want something, it's not good enough. So we've got to change the access, and who has the access, and empower people take this government back for the people and by them. Yes?
Yes. Speaking of democracy, I know this is not an issue that's on top of anybody's list right now, but a major fund issue in 2020, and that's the electoral college. To me, the fact that the person that's in the White House now has 3 million or less votes of his opponent is wrong. And you think there's any chance at all? I'm not commenting on that in the near future. The Democratic Congress, they may take that issue off.
So it's funny, I've had this question come up now at a number of my town halls. So clearly, people are really thinking about this issue. Here's what I'll say, and I've said this pretty consistently. We just went through a series of things that we could do in a piecemeal fashion via HR1 that would have the effect of empowering people and empowering the popular vote. There's a lot of things that are happening, particularly in the states that go one way or the other. The voter suppression, the not enrolling people, you know, not, you know, having that just a holiday. That is all an effort, you know, to diminish the value of the vote in those critical states. And we can do away with those limitations, those impediments, and that's a doable step. We have a better chance of getting out in front of the issue that you identified with electoral college. I think making the electoral college the, or changing it or doing away with it, making that the goal, would be in many respects sort of like saying, we're not going to do anything, or we're really going to focus a lot of our attention on overturning Citizens United, rather than taking some steps that we know can at least offset the dynamic of Citizens United. Because who knows when we're actually going to have a court that actually we're contemplating doing it. So I don't necessarily disagree with the spirit of your argument and potentially considering what we can do over time to that. I mean, if you know the origins of the Electoral College and sort of where it came from and why it came to pass, it was never really based on anything arguably noble. So with that, right, I'm not against it. I just rather focus on those things that we can get done in a piecemeal fashion that can help us offset the undermining that's happening to the population. Yes?
A question which you brought up, Citizens United, and the whole problem with the money and politics being that I don't think, because I'm a very wealthy person, my voice or vote should count for more than the person sitting next to me and vice versa if I'm poor. What is your opinion, or would you be willing to promote the idea of amending the Constitution to, as in a very simple way, to say money is not speech and corporations are not people?
The notion that a corporation is a person is indeed a legal fiction. There's no way around that. It is a made up notion, a made up concept. And we do need to draw a clear distinction between people and corporations. And the reason, it's a sleight of hand, the reason why you want to treat corporations, not people, but the argument, the reason why folks want to treat corporations as people is because they want to give corporations rights in the same way that we have. We have the right to free speech. Right? We have the right to politically express ourselves. Right? So that's even more talking about financing campaigns, right? From the individual standpoint, I hesitate to say, I'm going to take away entire give to an individual candidate on an individual level, and they're totally public. I think there is some value to some degree in individuals having the capacity to politically express themselves through their hard work to rally behind a candidate, right? That makes some sense. A little different when we put that same logic in the realm of corporations, which are not individuals, right? They're made up of shareholders with different interests, competing interests, and the only predominant interest is capital. The only predominant interest is shareholder value, profit. That's the only commonality. And so when you're speaking in the form of a corporation, you're speaking for profit. You're not speaking for your employees. You're speaking for the shareholders. And so you're right. What you have identified is clearly a problem. I don't know if we have the ability, or I shouldn't say the ability, but anything is possible. But it would be very difficult, given the jurisprudence in this space at this point, for the legislative body to not attempt to do something and not have to immediately challenge our constitutional basis. It would only because we have jurisprudence, only because there is now a history of precedent that is sort of codified corporations as people. I'm not saying it's not impossible to take on, but I do think that given the jurisprudence of the space, it would be a very complicated fight to take on. So I'm not against it, but again, as you can tell from sort of my approach, I tend to like to take on fights that I think are the kind of fights that can make real change, and the kind of fights that, you know, we can actually win in the short term, right? There are long fights, and then there are, you know, short fights. And key is, we have, it's like urgent care. We got some serious issues that we got to tend to now. We're bleeding, right? We got triage we got to go through here. There's certain things we got to figure out if we can get done now. In a very divided, very politically divisive time, partisan time. There's some structural impediments right now that are getting in our way. And we can take on those structural impediments, no doubt. But what can we do within those structural impediments that can at least give us some room to breathe and some room to come together and continue to make change over time? So that's kind of how I try to position myself in this space. All right, we'll do a couple more. Yes.
Yeah, you're
going to
go back to Washington next week.
Yeah, don't send me back to
the city. Okay, sorry. You're going to MSNBC, and I don't want you to go there and say those
things. I don't feel cool. Just to be clear, you won't see me on MSNBC. You won't see me on CNN. You won't see me out front. I don't do the national. I do the local.
Okay. Well, wherever you go, you want to be able to go there and say that LA and Oxford County is worried about impeaching the crash and how to
Yes.